Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRoche Show. I am pleased to bring to you this conversation with an absolute legend in economics. We are joined today by Dr. Art Laffer. He is the chairman and founder of Laffer Associates. He's known as the father of supply-side economics, the inventor of the Laffer curve, and he also served on President Reagan's Economic Policy Advisory Board for both terms. In this episode, Dr. Laffer explains why the macro picture is headed in the wrong direction. We also got into Dr. Laffer's newest book, Taxes Have Consequences, and why he favors a low, broad-based flat rate tax. He also explains why the Keynesian economists are wrong. We also got into money. We discussed the US dollar, Bitcoin, and the Federal Reserve. We recorded this on Wednesday, March 20th, ahead of the FOMC meeting. I really enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Laffer. I learned so much from him, and I know you will too. Dr. Art Laffer, for folks who are watching and listening, he served as a member of President Reagan's Economic Policy Advisory Board for both terms. He is also the author of the new book, Taxes Have Consequences. Dr. Laffer, it is an absolute privilege and honor to welcome you on the show today. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
My pleasure. Thank you. It's fun. By the way, there are two other co-authors with that book, Dr. Brian Dmitrovic and Dr. Jane Sinkfield also. So I was the junior author, just joking.
I love it. Well, we'll be sure to link it in the show notes for folks as well so they can pick up a copy. And Dr. Laffer, I'm excited to have you. And I know a lot of the audience, they're familiar with you and your career and your background. And I was hoping we could start where I always start with my guests, and that is to get their big picture macro view of the economy, the framework in which they are looking at the world today. And one of the things about this show, Dr. Laffer, is you can take all the time you need to set the table, if you will, when it comes to that macro picture.
I'd love to. Let me, if I can, just sort of frame it as an economist. Now, remember, I'm an economist, and that's really pretty much all I'll talk about. I'll joke about all sorts of other topics, but on a serious level, it's just economics. And when I look at the overall economy, I break it into sort of the major macroeconomic categories that you'd find in a big textbook. You know, I call it the five pillars of prosperity, or the five kingdoms of macroeconomic. Number one is taxes. Number two is government spending. Number three is monetary policy, inflation. Number four is regulatory policy. And number five is international trade. Those are the five kingdoms. And what I like to do when I look at the overall economy, and I like to sort of range it myself, I like to look at sort of what the ideal is in each of these kingdoms, if you will. Now, with regard to taxes, for example, the ideal tax system is to have the lowest possible tax rate on the broadest possible tax base. So you provide people with the least incentives to evade, avoid, or otherwise not report taxable income, and you have the broadest tax base. So you provide people with the least areas where they can put their income and avoid paying taxation. That's sort of the North Star: low rate, broad base, flat tax. Spending restraint. If you look at spending, government spending is needed. It's a very important part of our overall economy. The judiciary, military, schools. I mean, I could go on and on, but there are limits. If you go back, let's say, to 1910, I think total government spending was about 3% of GDP. Today it's maybe 35, I don't know, but very much larger today. If you look at there, I like to describe the North Star on spending as being spending restraint. If government spending is too low, you need to increase it, that's for sure. But if it's too high, you need to bring it down. And I think today it's fair to say that it's way too high and we should bring in spending restraint. So low rate, broad-based, flat tax, spending restraint. With regard to money, you want to have sound money. What you really want to have is the result of monetary policy being that there is a stable price level, so that if you and I make a contract in a futures market, whether it be a bond or a futures contract, whatever, we will know what the value of a dollar bill is 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, so we can have very well, fully informed markets to allow long-term transactions to take place. So stable money is really important there. Low rate, broad based, flat tax, spending restraint, sound money. Number four is regulations. And again, we all need regulations. You can't wake up in the morning one day and drive on the left-hand side of the road, and then the next day decide to change your mind and drive on the right-hand side of the road. We understand we all need regulations, but what you want to make sure is that these regulations do not go beyond the specific purposes at hand and create a lot of collateral damage to the overall economy. So I would say regulatory restraint, I would call that one. The last one is free trade, and this is the one where you get into a lot of controversy, especially with conservatives. But I'm a free trader. You know, there are some things we produce better than foreigners, and there's some things foreigners produce more efficiently than we do. We and they would be foolish in the extreme if we didn't sell them those products we make more efficiently than they do in exchange for those products they make more efficiently than we do. It's a win-win. It's called the gains from trade, comparative advantage. David Ricardo, I don't care what you say, but it's really, really an important pillar of prosperity. So low rate, broad-based flat tax, spending restraint, sound money, minimal regulations, and free trade. That's the sort of framework I go every day. I wake up and I look at the world afresh, look at the news, and I ask myself, in each of those kingdoms, are we moving closer to the North Star, or are we moving further away? And let me give you my sort of rundown of the last 3 years under Joe Biden. Is with regard to taxes, we're moving further and further away. The capital gains tax has increased dramatically because we have illusory capital gains because of inflation. Depreciation of plant and equipment expenditures has been diminished, not below the replacement value because of the inflation. You see all sorts of other taxes, the 80,000 new IRS officers. I'm just sort of categorizing, putting my arm around the trunk of the tree. With regard to tax policy, we're moving away from the ideal, not towards it, which is a big negative. Government spending, spending restraint. There has been no government spending restraint whatsoever in this administration or in the ever since we had COVID. There's been no spending restraints whatsoever. And again, the ideal of limited government spending is absolutely a pie in the sky, not true. So when I look at the ideal and government spending, we're moving away from that ideal, not towards it. Again, another huge negative. Monetary policy. And here what I like to look at is I like to look at the monetary base of the Fed. The Fed's monetary base has gone way, way up. And if you go back to 2008, I think it was about $1 trillion then, a little less than $1 trillion. It's now $7.5 trillion. It was as high as $9 trillion. You can see the consequences of that, especially under Biden. We've had a huge increase in the price level of something like 18 or 19%, a clear sign of very bad monetary policy. We've been moving away from the ideal, not towards it. So whether it be taxes moving away from the ideal, spending moving away from the ideal, monetary policy moving away from the ideal, and regulations. I mean, we put on all these regulations now on energy companies. We put on all these other regulations all across the board. Again, we all know we need, but regulatory restraint is clearly not in the cards. Again, in the fourth kingdom of macroeconomics, we're moving very much away from the ideal, and it's hurting the economy. And lastly, free trade. And, you know, again, you've had all of these sanctions, all of these things done. You know, with trade, it's most important, Julia, that we trade with those people we don't like. Because, you know, when you trade with people, when you do business with people, you develop good relationships. You get to understand their situations. They get to understand your situations, all of that. You know, free trade is most important with respect to those people we consider our enemies, like Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. Now, I'm not suggesting we trade nuclear weapons with these people. That is not what I'm suggesting. But you never win over people. You never do by prohibiting them from trading with you. If you look at it, I can remember, I think we put on sanctions on Cuba in 1959. And you can see how well that's worked. Cuba now loves us. They're a free market, democratic, economic, capitalist country in love with America. Not. You know, sanctions, barriers to trade are really damaging to the U.S. economy and to U.S. international policy. So when I look at the five pillars of prosperity, taxes, spending, money, regulations, and trade, I think the U.S. economy is moving in the wrong direction in every single one of these. And the consequences of that have been dramatic. You know, we can see what our price levels have been. You can see what employment to population has been. We've got one of the lowest levels of employment. When you look at the growth of the U.S., we are in a period of senescence, of declining power there for maybe the last 20, 25 years. I mean, almost ever since Bill Clinton left office, we've been in a period of senescence. Now, it's not just the U.S., Julia. It's the whole world. European Union is in terrible shape. It's also declining. Russia, I mean, people don't even know if there's a country called Russia anymore. China has, under Xi, has turned around to the economy in China. It's beginning a huge collapse in South America. Chile, which was the Wirtschaftswunder of the world, has all of a sudden flipped over with the new left-wing governments, and it's coming straight down. You can see that in Brazil as well. You can see it in Canada, the U.S. I'd love to use the one in Britain, because Britain, it's got so bad that they're no longer calling it the British pound. They're calling it the British ounce. Just a joke. But that's how I look at the world. Now, am I optimistic about the future? The future will take a political change to bring us back into prosperity. But right now, the U.S. is probably the tallest midget in the body politic for the world. Japan. Do you remember the days when they were talking about the real challenge of Japan? Japan's capital market was the same market cap as the U.S. It was just amazing. Not anymore. So the whole world is going in the wrong direction, including the U.S. And, you know, that's my outlook for the world. I don't know if that makes sense, but it will take changes in all five of those grand kingdoms of macroeconomics. We need now lower, broader base flat taxes. We need spending restraint. We need sound money. We need minimal regulations, and we need freer trade. And that is the only way we can turn this huge behemoth around and create the prosperity that the world deserves. And thank you for letting me blether on it ad nauseum and boring your audience to death. But that's
how I
look at the world.
Well, I love it. And I know the audience loves it, and listening to you and learning from you, and you're helping all of us learn and get better. My follow-on question for you, Dr. Laffer, is you outline these five kingdoms, these five pillars, and they're all moving away from the North Star. So my follow-on is, what were the forces that kind of got us in this situation where it's not just the U.S., it's a global thing? What were those forces at play? Or how? I guess maybe the simple question is, how did we get here in this situation?
Well, it's always your herd animal. When you go to Sweden, or you go to Estonia, or whether you go to Zimbabwe, or you go any... They've all have the same sort of media. They all have the same look, and it's a herd mentality of viewing the world. The question is let me just give you the basic model. When you raise tax rates, what happens? I mean, that's a question. Do you get more revenues or less revenues? You know, that's it. You know, to me, people don't work because they're jobs. People work to get paid, and they work to get paid after tax. To the other people, they work because they're jobs. And I don't think that, you know, and I think it's two very different models of the world. People don't save because their incomes are high. That's not why they save. They save to make an after-tax rate of return on their savings, for goodness sakes. And when you look at taxes, again, you know, if the government's running short of revenues and they raise tax rates like Joe Biden is talking about and stuff like that, what happens? Well, I think the economy collapses, and often they get less revenues, especially if they tax the very highest income earners, and the economy will underperform. They don't believe that. These are two very different models of the world. They've been around from time immemorial, and it's what I like to call the growthists and the redistributionists. And, you know, if you look at that model, it's the difference between Keynesian and supply-side economics. I mean, if you tax people who work and you pay people who don't work, I believe that we're going to get less people working. The redistributionists believe you're going to take away from the fat cats rich people and allow the poor people more opportunity to have income and do better in life. You know, I think they're just totally wrong, and I think all the evidence points in the opposite direction. But those are the two views. And it's sort of the difference between an accountant and an economist. The Keynesians, my dear friends at Harvard and Yale and MIT and Princeton, you know, I went to Yale undergraduate. I got my PhD at Stanford. I taught and went through all the ranks at the University of Chicago. So I'm an academic. That's what I do. And my colleagues, I like them all very much, but they're ignorant. And they don't understand economics. And it is especially true of the people like Saez and Piketty and Sancheva and Zuckman and some of these others, who are these redistributionists, you know, the wanting to tax the rich. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, they're just plain wrong. And if they would only look at the facts. Now, I can understand their model, Julia. It's possible that if you raise tax rates, the rich would just pay those taxes, the poor would be better off, and the rich would work just as hard as they would. Or it's also possible if you raise tax rates on the rich stop working, they shelter their income, they shift around everything around, and they pay less in taxes, they work less, and the poor get hammered. Both of those are possible. It's not a matter of your opinion in this. People don't have a right to their opinion. This is not how you feel. This is about facts. And what you find in the book, and I have every single tax return from 1913 to the present. It's not as though I've got limited data or anything. We've got every time we've raised tax rates on the rich, every time, the economy has underperformed. We've collected less tax revenues from the rich, and the poor have been hammered. Every time we've cut tax rates on the rich, the economy has outperformed, tax revenues from the rich have increased, and the poor have benefited disproportionately in the U.S. economy. And it's not just the U.S., it's every state. Which states are the best producing states? How about Florida? How about Texas? How about Tennessee? How about Nevada? How about South Dakota? How about New Hampshire? I mean, I could go on. They're the zero income tax states. Duh. You know, Nevada. I mean, you know, which states are the worst performers? How about Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Illinois,
California.
California. You know, so you watch all of these. Now, California is an interesting case. California is not so cut and dried. California has a very interesting tax rate. They're the worst in every tax except property taxes. And my latest books, again, with Dr. Sinkfield and Dr. Dmitrovic, is going to be on state policies. And California has Prop 13, which is the most ingenious, wonderful plan that has ever. And it allows California to way outperform what you would think it would be doing because of Prop 13 and other features of property tax limitations. So, but that's where we are. I think the evidence is just overwhelming, but none of these guys will debate me. I wish they would, but they won't. And you know what you ought to do is get an honest to God debate, make it about a 4-hour debate. I would love to do it with Saez, but he's, I'm going to use a bad word, but he's a gallino, a chicken. He's afraid to debate because we use his data to show our results. So, and Piketty, of course, is so arrogant and so full of himself that he won't do any of these debates. And he's wrong, just always wrong. You know when someone's wrong when they refuse to debate. I would not demean myself. Hell, I was university professor. I did Stanford. That's not that shabby. Yale honors. You know, maybe I'm no good. Maybe that's it. But, you know, it's not as though I'm some local yokel from the street people, you know. And they will not debate. And, you know, I have had a number of debates on these issues. And you could look them all up. And, you know, when they do, these guys don't have a chance. And the reason they don't debate is because they're plain wrong.
Yeah.
They could be right, but the facts don't conform to what they say.
And also for the folks watching, listening, Chapter 2, you when you were talking about this, you go over all of the ways that folks shelter their taxes, too. Every time you get an increase, the different ways of avoidance and sheltering and whatnot. It's really extensive in that chapter.
People respond to incentives, and rich people like their money, too.
Yeah.
You know, and rich people figure out all these ways. They can hire lawyers. They can hire accountants. They can hire deferred income specialists. They can hire lobbyists. They can buy politicians, and they do, and they have the means to do it too. They're rich. So don't be surprised when rich people find out all the ways around this. Of course, and if they don't find out all the ways around it, you see a guy in Goldman Sachs 1 year designing a plan, then he goes and works in the government for the next year, gets that plan passed through Congress, boom. You know, don't be surprised. That's why you have a low rate, broad-based flat tax as the North Star. So you get government out of this. So what businesses don't make money by lobbying government, businesses make money by producing high quality products at low cost. That's what you want. But that's not what these guys get, because when you raise taxes on them, they don't think it's right. And they're correct.
Hey there, I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. So you're known as the father of supply side economics, and it makes me wonder, like, listening to you, Does it all come down to incentives and getting the incentives right?
Yes, 100%. I mean, if you tax, that joke, and they said, if you tax people who work and pay people who don't work, you're going to get a lot of people not working. if you have two locations, A and B, if you raise taxes in B and you lower them in A, producers and manufacturers and people are going to move from B to A. You know, these people will change the timing of their income. You know, this was a big deal in the 50s where you had these very nice pension benefit plans. So you could smooth that out because tax rates were so high. People had very defined benefit plans that, you know, really worked well for them. You know, they do that. They change the composition of their income. They do all, they change the location, the timing, the volume, and the composition of their income, all because of taxes, regulations, all the incentive structures. That's what they do. Let me, if I can, go through it. And this isn't ideological, Julia. This isn't Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative. It's not. It's facts. Let me, if I can, do what we call the transfer theorem. Now, this is a pure, simple, straightforward math. And it's just plain math. A transfer occurs when the government takes from one person and gives that to another person. You know, from tall people to short people, all right. You know, from young people to old people, all right. That's my type too. It can be from Easterners to Westerners to, you know, all, there are any number of ways there are transfers occur. All government spending that is not purchase of goods and services is a transfer. Now, the normal way we think of transfers, the sort of idealized way, is thinking of it from those who have a little bit more to those who have a little bit less. We usually think of transfers in terms of redistribution of income. You follow me in this?
Yes, yes.
And I want to go through that with you, and I'm going to do the theorem. I'm going to prove the theorem to you verbally. So forgive me, it's not math, but it's verbal. You know, what the transfer here, redistribution theorem, transfer theorem is here, is you take from those who have a little bit more and you give it to those who have a little bit less. You with me?
Yes.
Now, by taking from those who have a little bit more, you reduce their incentives to produce and they will produce a little bit less. With me?
Yes.
By giving to those who have a little bit less, you provide them with an alternative source of income other than working. And they, too, will produce a little bit less. The theorem here is clear as it can be. Every single time you redistribute income, you have transfer payments, you reduce total income, period. It works whether you're tall or short, black or white, liberal or conservative. I don't give a damn who you are. Transfers always reduce total income. Now, the Keynesians say they don't, but they do. Whenever you transfer income, you reduce total income. Now, the lemma from this theorem is beautiful. It has a little piquant flavor with garlic salt on it. Oh, it's so tasty. The lemma from this, and I'm not going to prove this one verbally to you, but I'm just going to describe it. I think you'll see it as intuitive. The more you redistribute, the greater will be the reduction in total income. You with me on that?
I am, yes.
Great. That's the lemma. Now, the limit function of this. Now, I want to go to the limit function of this theorem because it's just math, but I'm describing it to you verbally because it's easier for most people to understand than doing the formulas. But the limit function is very simply, and I wish Bernie Sanders were here or Elizabeth Warren or AOC or any of these, most Republicans, most Democrats all deny everything I'm going to tell you. The limit function here is if you were able to redistribute income so that everyone comes out the exact same, there will be no income whatsoever. Let me prove it to you, if I can. In order to get everyone to come out exactly the same, what you would have to do is you'd have to tax everyone above the average income, 100% of their excess over the average income. And you'd have to subsidize everyone below the average income 100% up to the average income. Only by doing this can you assure that everyone will come out exactly the same. Now, if you actually did that, if you actually taxed everyone above the average income 100% of the excess, and if you actually subsidize everyone below the average income up to the average income, I will stipulate today, counselor, we'll all come out equal at zero. There will be no income. Now, that is math. That's not hypothesis that said, well, I'm a liberal, oh God, right winger. No, it's someone can add and subtract and multiply and divide. Now, I have problems with my students with this because, you know, they don't know the workaday world and that. So I tried to make an example, give them an example that they would think was intuitive on this theorem. And so I made the theorem this way. I said, you know, if I ran this class the way your government runs your country, what I would do is I'd flunk all the A students out and I'd give all the F students scholarships. Now I can see you smiling there.
They wouldn't like that.
Before you giggle, think about it for a second. Think about it. My A students happen to be a little bit brighter and happen to be a little bit smarter than my F students. So once I've changed the rules, my A students are able to get lower grades than my F students because they never randomly make the mistake of guessing a correct answer. My A students still get all the scholarships. My F students still flunk out. I have not changed the distribution of grades one iota. But what have I done? I've destroyed the entire quality of the educational process. You know, when you try to redistribute income, you do not succeed in redistributing income, but what you do succeed is destroying income. You know, every revolution on planet Earth in all of history, they've all been fought to change the distribution of income. And never has one of those revolutions ever succeeded. But what they all have succeeded in doing is destroying income and the lots and the incomes of people and concern. We are in the middle of a massive redistribution revolution in this world right today, with all these people trying to forgive student loans and pay, give more welfare, all that stuff, all this bailing out countries and all this stuff. And all we've succeeded in doing is destroying the growth upon which all economic beneficence ultimately rests, is the strength of the economy, growth. And we are destroying all of that by these policies. Now, that's why I went through the five kingdoms with you carefully. And please forgive me for going through this stuff so quickly with you, Julia. But it's important for you and your audience and the world at large to understand. And I don't know how to explain it any other way than this. It's just plain math. And it's not opinion. I would just as happy being a liberal if the facts supported liberals, but they don't.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job explaining, Dr. Laffer. And again, I'm enjoying listening to you, and I love your examples. And I'm sure the one for the students was a great example, by the way. I have a question for you. If it all comes down to incentives, how could we get the incentives right, maybe from the politicians' side? You know, if we're talking about incentives, are there incentives that maybe they could understand this better or get it right? I mean,
no, not really. I mean, you know, politicians are politicians. They're in it for themselves. And I don't know, but I've never heard of a politician dying poor.
No,
you know, it's what they do. And of course, they get off on control and power. And the only way they're going to stop going for control and going for power if it's became profitable for them not to. Now, I have proposed, as you might imagine, I have proposed putting all politicians on commission. In other words, let's imagine I did it with a little bit with tongue in cheek, but not really. Merit pay for politicians, I think, makes all the sense in the world. I mean, if the economy grows at 3%, I'd let politicians keep their pay straight, clean, bum, bum, bum. No problem. If it grows at 4%, double their pay. Grows at 5%, triple their pay. Grows at 2%, they don't get any pay. Grows at 1%, they owe us what they would have been paid had it grown at 3%. These politicians do not bear the consequences of their own actions. And as a result, they don't care about what the consequences are as long as they do well personally. And having power, you look at those guys in the committee hearings, you look at what happens in these trial cases, you look at what happens all over the place. There's not a Republican or a Democrat who doesn't call on the government to solve their problems. We need to investigate the Bidens. We need to investigate. Now, get the hell out of the way. Please, just zip it up. Get out of there. Let the population, let the economy solve its own problems. You don't want to tip the scales in favor of Americans or against Americans. There's no reason why Americans can't have free trade with foreigners without the U.S. government trying to tip the scales in one direction or another. There's no reason why we should be anti-rich or anti-poor, or pro-rich or pro-poor. We're pro-everyone. You want to have prosperity across the board. At some stage, I'd like to do the Keynesian multiplier, which is what you know, everyone has been taught in their macroeconomics class in college, and which is what, you know, we want. It's called stimulus spending. You've heard of it. It's all just transfer payments. That's all it is. But I want to go through it in a Keynesian description, because I remember being in London, and Larry Summers was visiting London, and he had a big article in the Financial Times, and he explained it. This was back many, many years, when he explained why we were doing this stimulus spending, and I think it was the tax rebate, something like that. And he explained it to the English audience, you know, as a Lord Keynes would have done it beautifully. Larry's a very articulate, very smart guy. I've known him forever and ever. And he explained Keynesian spending and the impact on the economy this way. He said, if I give a guy $600 that guy otherwise would not have had, that guy will spend more than he otherwise would have spent had he not had that $600. Of course he will. And that in turn will create jobs, output, employment for the people who now are providing him with the goods and services that he's now demanding, that he wouldn't have been able to demand had he not had the $600. That in turn will create more income, more output, more employment of the group supplying this guy with the $600. They in turn will have higher incomes. They'll spend more. That will create more jobs. And there'll be this cascading down through the system as this $600 affects when they're way through. And what it will be, and I'm going to be a little geeky and nerdy with you, but you know, the spending out of the new income is called the marginal propensity to consume. If you sum up all of these events throughout the whole process, it's called the multiplier. It's 1 over 1 minus the marginal propensity to consume. That's the multiplier. You multiply that times the $600 initial transfer boom payment, and that's how much GDP will increase. Now, you have to separate it over different quarters or years, all of that. So, but you with me?
Yes, I am.
That's what Larry Summers said to the audience, and then he walked and sat down. What? He went and sat down. Well, let me just tell you, what Larry Summers said is true. If you give a guy $600, that guy will spend more than he otherwise would have spent. That will create jobs, output, employment, and higher incomes. They'll spend more, and there will be this cascading effect through the economy, the sum of which will be the multiplier times the 600. That's true, but that's only partial truth. That's the first chapter of a 3-chapter book. The second chapter is, where does the government get that $600? They have to take it from someone else. Government doesn't create resources. Government redistributes resources. So the $600 I give to this one guy, all right, and that has the multiplier effect through, I have to take from someone else. Now, the person I take the $600 from, won't they now spend less than they otherwise would have spent had they not had their $600 taken from them? Won't this in turn cause them to demand less goods and services than they otherwise would have purchased? Yes. Won't that in turn cause those people to have lower incomes? Yes. Won't they spend less? There'll be an exact equal and opposite effect. It's the second entry of a 2-entry accounting statement that the multiplier effect times the transfer payer exactly offsets the multiplier effect of the transfer recipient. To the second, to the minute, to the hour, to the day, to the week, to the month, to the year, to the 9,365th decimal place. You know, there is no stimulus from stimulus spending. The stimulus to the transfer recipient is offset 100% by the destimulus to the taxpayer or the transfer payer, period. Now, that's chapter 2. And I've tried to explain this math because it's so important that you understand the math, but in common terms so that normal people can understand it. You know, the way I try to explain it, if the price of apples rises, it is true that apple growers will be wealthier, they'll have more income, and they'll spend more. But it's equally as true, is it not, Julia, that if apple prices rise, apple consumers will be poorer, they'll be less wealthy, and they'll spend less. Those two effects are exactly equal to and opposite from each other. The income effects, this is called the Slutsky equation, and God, I wish I could just do it in a blackboard, but it's the Slutsky equation, is the sum of the income effects always sum to zero, always. But now here's the catch, the third chapter. The third chapter of this little book is the substitution effects. The substitution effects don't cancel. If the price of apples goes up, apple producers, will produce more apples and consume less apples, won't they? If the price of apples goes up, apple consumers will consume less apples and they'll produce more apples too. The substitution effects all work in the same direction to every entity in the economy. Higher prices mean all people buy less of them and all people produce more of them. That's the substitution effect. Now let's take a look at this in regard to the U.S. economy on the transfer payment, the thing that you're taught of in your classical Keynesian class, which is just taught incorrectly, totally incorrectly, is that if you have the transfer payment, okay, there you have the spending, you can see that the income effects of the transfer recipient are exactly offset by the income effects of the transfer payer. I was talking with Senator Gaylord Nelson, then testifying on this. God, I think it was in 1974 when Gerry Ford was president and they did that tax rebate plan there. And Otto Eckstein was there, Gardner Ackley was there, and Otto Eckstein, Gardner Ackley, and Paul McCracken were the three other testifiers. And they all thought this was a great thing to have the stimulus, the tax rebate, and all that. And I tried to explain the substitution effects to Senator Nelson. And I just couldn't. I just was so frustrated because it was just so hard for me to explain it. So I said, Senator Nelson, if these other three economists are correct, what in the hell's the matter with you? If the world operates the way these guys say, why stop at $600? Why not $6,000? $60,000, $600,000, $6 million. Why not 100% of GDP? So that everyone who works and produces receives nothing, and all those who don't work and don't produce receive everything. Tell me, what do you think would happen to GDP? And of course, the answer is it'd go to zero. Bingo. And so the Senator Nelson then leaned over to the other three people, says, what's wrong with Dr. Laffer's comments on that? Well, and they all three said, oh, well, Dr. Laffer's correct in the extreme, but in the range we're talking about right here, it works in the opposite direction. My badushka. It doesn't operate in the different direction anywhere. It's just bad economics. And it's the same way on trade. why do countries and people export? To earn the wherewithal to buy imports. The reason you earn income is so you can buy things. The reason country export goods and services so they can buy goods and services from other countries. If you prohibit them, if you put tariffs on imports, you are equally putting a tax on exports and you destroy trade totally. I mean, the supply of goods and services to the rest of the world is the demand for goods and services from the rest of the world. So that's why tariffs work very much. It's called Lerner's Symmetry Theorem. It's just simple math, but it's so true. And it just disgusts me to hear professional economists spouting absolute nonsense nonstop. Yet we put on a massive tariff. We started in the fourth quarter of 1929. It was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff. It passed the House and the Senate in the fourth quarter of 1929. It was signed into law in June of 1930 by Herbert Hoover. It did there. The market collapsed. It started collapsing in the fourth quarter of 1929 in anticipation of this. The market dropped by 30%. It was going to drop totally by 95% by the time all of this stuff was over. Total trade dropped by a factor of 4, okay? But the trade balance, all those tariffs on imports, the trade balance stayed the same. The same impact on imports as on exports, which just goes to prove symmetry theorem is true. But let me tell you what it did do. It caused the Great Depression. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff was it. Bob Mundell, my colleague, my mentor, my hero, the guy I think is probably the best economist in the last two centuries, he argued in his Nobel laureate talk, he said it was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff that caused the Great Depression, that caused World War II. I believe that to be true as well. And when you look at my colleagues, professional economists, they are not acting professionally. And it just disgusts the living hell out of me. And I can take it. It's not just liberals, it's conservatives as well. They just don't know their economics. And I'm glad to debate any one of them on any of these issues. Let's do it. Let's set it up with enough time. If you'd like to do it. Why don't you? Call and ask Saez. He's out at Berkeley. Ask him. What's he afraid of? I mean, let's do it. Let's have it a big one, and let's have you do the podcast of it, and let's make it 2 or 3 hours so we don't have cliches and one-liners. You know, the cliches and one-liners, you run out of those after about an hour.
Yeah, no
sound
bites.
Then you start getting serious. I did this with Walter Heller before the Reagan tax cuts at whatchamacallit University just south of Stanford. I'll think of it in a second. But it was a three-hour debate, and by the time we got through 3 hours, it exhausted all of Walter Heller's bon mot, and then he got the issues there, and he was sorely wanting. He just was wrong. And as a result, you can see what happened with Reagan's tax cuts. It worked. Mm-hmm. As you
do. I have a question for you. Is one of the problems because everyone comes from like kind of the same school of thought, like the Keynesian school of thought?
Well, that's because there's only one university in the world. Academics should like select their successors.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to select? I mean, I don't know what your political leanings are, but I would doubt that very many Democrats would select Trumpies for their successors, and I doubt very many Trumpies would select Bidenese as their successors. So what you get is this built-in monolithic structure, and once a mistake is inherent in the structure, there is no process by which they can get it removed. They can't. The system is self-contained. There is no way you can get your PhD, or you can become a professor, you can get tenure, you can get promoted, you can get your articles published without towing the party line. And no one does it deliberately. It's just, I know what's right. And so if this guy has a paper that I know is wrong, I'm not going to accept it. And it becomes a self-fulfilling process, a self-selection.
Yeah. Well, while I have you here, Dr. Laffer, one of the things I remember, at least from undergrad, was the Laffer curve. And this is something you're famous for, and bringing the Laffer curve to macroeconomics. Can you explain it for the folks who are watching and listening? And wasn't there a story with a napkin in the Laffer curve?
Isn't the world wonderful? I love this stuff. There is a story that it's probably not true. Although, have you ever told a good joke?
Have I? I don't know. Well, my jokes aren't that funny.
Yeah. Have told a good joke.
Okay.
And once they get everyone to laugh once, they keep telling that joke until it doesn't work any longer. It's like me and the Laffer curve. Once I did it once, wow, that's neat. I drew it every table, everywhere, all the time. So I have no idea which napkin, which restaurant, which time really was. But the Laffer curve is very simple. Tax rates have two effects on revenues. If you raise tax rates, it is true. You collect more tax revenue per dollar of tax base. Yeah, that's true. But it's also true that if you raise tax rates, you reduce people's incentives for reporting income or reporting that tax base, and so you'll get a smaller tax base. This is called the arithmetic effect and the economic effect, all right? The arithmetic effect is you raise rates, you collect more revenue on the same tax base. That's arithmetic effect. The economic effect, if you raise tax rates, you'll get a smaller tax base. These two effects always work in the opposite direction, always. So if you have 110% tax rates, so every time you go to the office, instead of getting a check, you get a bill. Sooner or later, you're going to stop working and there'll be no revenues. Likewise, if tax rates are at zero, so they don't collect, no matter how much you earn, you're not going to pay taxes. So again, tax revenue is zero. So at tax rates, it goes 0%, you'll have no revenue. And at tax rates, 100%, you'll have no revenue either. You follow me?
Yes.
Now, if you start lowering that tax rate from 100% to 99% to 98% to 97% down, sooner or later, someone will go back to work and revenue will start increasing. Boom. And so as you lower the rates, revenue starts increasing, but at a slower and slower rate. Now, if you go down to 0%, if you raise the tax rate from 0% to 1%, some people will quit working, but not many, and you'll start getting more revenue from that way. And if you go all the way up, as soon as you rise, it goes at a decreasing rate, and you find that you have a curve like this, which is what is called the Laffer curve. I want you to be very clear on this and your listeners that it's a pedagogic device. It's not a literal device of measure. You know, where is that now? You know, it's much more but it does show you the two effects tax rates have on the revenue per dollar of tax base and the incentives for reporting the tax base. Those two. That is the whole reason why we did taxes have consequences. That is the whole reason why my book, which was a New York Times bestseller in 2014, which is The Wealth of States, which is the 30,000 foot view of state economics. You know, it's the whole reason for all of these things is my students, you know, could do the math, but seeing it alive, you can price a product so high that no one buys it and you lose money. You can price a product so low that everyone buys it, but you make no profits and you lose money. There's a price in there that is sort of the perfect price for the maximum profits. Same thing with taxes. There's a correct tax rate. And it depends on how long you're willing to wait and all these other things. But tax rates are always there. You never should raise tax rates when revenues go down. Ever. Now, you shouldn't necessarily raise them when revenues go up. You shouldn't. But at least you should never do it when revenues go down. Why would you hurt everyone and collect less money?
Do you think we'll ever see a day where we, here in the U.S., where we have that low, broad-based, flat tax rate?
We came really close. Now, we did it with Ronald Reagan. If you'll remember when we came into office, when God still loved the earth and the manger was shining bright in that star, and Reagan took office in 1981. You know, at that time, the highest marginal income tax rate was 70%. You know, capital gains tax rate had just been lowered a little bit. They had been about 50% then. It was at 28%. Reagan cut the highest marginal income tax rate from 70% to 28% in his term there in office. We cut the capital gains tax rate from 28% to 20%. We cut the corporate rate from 46% to 34%. What we did is we took 11 tax brackets and made it down to 2. We reduced the highest rate from 70% to 28%. We raised the lowest rate from 12.5% to 15%. So we went from this god-awful tax structure to 2 rates, a 28% and 15%. We dropped the corporate rate way down as well. We were moving very much towards that North Star. I mean, we were at rocket ship speed towards that North Star in taxes. That bill. Now, I told you what it was. We dropped the highest rate from 70 to 28. We raised the lowest from 12.5 to 15%. We cut the corporate rate from 46 to 34%. Can you imagine a bill like that in Congress today? No. It wouldn't get a Republican vote or a Democratic vote. You want to know what the vote was in the Senate in 1986? You ready for this? 97-3. Only 3 senators voted against it. Simon from Illinois, that little guy with the bow tie, blah, 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 blah. 11 from Michigan, and Merkel, I think from Montana, were the only 3. Bill Bradley voted for it. Tall and Pink voted for it. Teddy Kennedy voted for it. Joe Biden for it. Al Gore, they all voted. Why? Because they knew it was the right thing to do. And it was the right thing to do. Al Gore told me personally, he's a friend of mine, I admire him enormously. Al Gore told me he was the best bill he ever voted for. Now we've got these guys stuck in the bad model once again, sitting out there, being led on by these economists, and it's just very sad. And there's another whole supply side story, and I don't know if you want to get into this today, I mean, of money. I mean, shall I go you a little bit on money?
Sure.
Because it's equally as bad as fiscal policy, and I'm not going to do the regulations of the trade, you know, but the money stuff is just shocking. And in 1913 was not only the year that the U.S. put in the progressive income tax, which it did. For the last 2 months of 1913, we had an income tax. The highest rate was 7%. But we also put in something called the Federal Reserve. Prior to 1913, the government of the United States did not control the quantity of money or the monetary system. Now, it is true that the government did define a dollar as 1/20th of an ounce of gold and 1 ounce of silver. They defined that. The government also did, prior to 1913, mint coins, silver and gold coins, but so did everyone else. They were not the only minters. Anyone who had a mint could print the coins and blah, 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 and have them out. All the banknotes, all the currency that flowed back then was all printed by banks. They were called banknotes. They weren't called Federal Reserve notes. They were called banknotes because the Federal Reserve didn't print them. These were all done that. The inflation rate for the prior 2 centuries had been 0% effectively. Now, once the Fed got into the big business from 1913, then we had the devaluation of the dollar in 1933 by Roosevelt from $20.67 an ounce of gold to $35 an ounce of gold, the confiscation of all gold into the Fort Knox. Then you had the prohibition on owning gold. You had all of this. Then you had the interest equalization tax under Kennedy. You had the voluntary foreign credit restraint program under Lyndon Johnson. Then you had the Smithsonian Accord in 1972, where we devalued gold again, where we took over the monetary system. And lastly, you have this stuff all now since 2008, where the Fed is massively involved in currencies. And you've seen nothing but huge increases in the Fed's balance sheet, a huge deterioration in the value of the dollar. And it's just gone to where no one wants the U.S. dollar anymore. The only thing the dollar is good at is against other really worse currencies. But the dollar is depreciated enormously against goods and services. That's why that's called inflation. It's depreciated enormously against gold. So we've had this whole government-controlled money system has been a huge failure in the world economy. And what the world is doing, what markets are doing, is searching for another private money. And one of the ways they search, and one of the reasons why the price of gold now is what, $2,130 an ounce. That's or right. Whatever it is, versus $35 an ounce, which it was, you know, not that long ago, is because people are trying to find value, transactions, media. Well, this is what I believe has led to all these cryptocurrencies. You know, the Bitcoin is 21 million Bitcoins. And I think this is a way of a private sector money coming back and once again pushing government money out of the situation. You know, I'm looking for a private alternative to government monies. And I think we're really doing experiment. I mean, the market cap of Bitcoin is about $1.3 trillion. You know, you're getting into there where you have a money base, a monetary base that's pretty substantial. And if the government doesn't try to close it down, and if I mean, they're getting almost to the point where they can't close it down, Julia, and I'm very excited about private monies taking over and getting rid of government monies and just having go back to private monies the way it was prior to 1913.
Do you like Bitcoin? Do you own it?
No, I don't own it.
Okay.
And I don't. I mean, look, and I'm 83 for God's
sake. Okay, I own some. I'm a millennial.
Well, then you made some money.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't own it. I do understand it a little bit. I'm scared of it. You know, I don't know why one makes it and one doesn't make it and all, boom, it goes to zero, you know. But, you know, I remember when there was a baseball card craze and, you know, all these other people collected stamps and all that stuff. But this seems to be different. This seems to be really creating an alternative currency. But when I talk to Bitcoin groupies, I'm upset because I don't think they understand what they're doing. I was on a call with my student. I don't know if you know Kathy Wood.
Of course. We're going to have her on the show at some point.
Well, yes. She was my student at USC. I think I'm the only outside individual owner of ARK. And she was wonderful, and I do all sorts of stuff with her. I just love her dearly. She's done a great job with this Bitcoin. And, you know, when I look at what's going on here, I think that Bitcoin may well be the right thing. She's just really good. And has done a great job with Bitcoin. And, you know, I hope we find a private money soon that can supplant and get rid of dollars. And all we need to do is develop means in which, you know, when you have a gold standard, which we had for centuries, you need to figure out how the government intervenes in the gold system and how they have a price rule. And you have to have periods of judicious suspension of convertibility to make sure that you are stabilizing the prices of goods and services rather than there would have been a lot of volatility in the price of gold historically if it hadn't been for the Bank of England having judicious suspensions of convertibility, then coming back to convertibility. So they used the gold standard to stabilize price levels for a century, two centuries. We need to be able to do that as well with something like Bitcoin. And those algorithms can be done. I can write those algorithms very easily. I wrote one for us going back on gold when Reagan was elected. I called reinstatement of the dollar the blueprint, which is I did in 1980 for the president. And we almost got it. I worked with James Baker on this and stuff, but we didn't get it. But we almost did. But there are ways you can do these algorithms to make it work. And so you don't lead to wild inflation or wild deflation. It keeps the dollars, the price of goods and services stable, which is what we want. We really want stable prices, not stable gold, but you can use gold or Bitcoin to make sure that happens.
Let me ask you this, because it is Fed Day. We're recording on the morning of Wednesday, March 20th. What is your assessment of the Fed, and what would you do differently if you were in Jerome Powell's seat?
I, from what I understand from all the people who know him, Jerome Powell appears to be a nice person. I know a bunch of the people in the Fed, not well, but I know them. They're all nice people. They're all affable, people well-met, good credentials and all that, but they don't understand money. And they really don't. Powell is not a, I mean, Paul Volcker told his staff what he was going to do. Jerome Powell asked his staff what he should do. There's no leadership there. Paul Volcker ran monetary policy following interest rates. Jerome Powell tries to set interest rates. The Fed should never, ever, ever try to set interest rates. The Fed should follow interest rates. So if the 91-day T-bill goes up, the Fed should change their discount rate to follow it. That's what they should do. They should not set the discount rate to control the 91-day T-bill. And it's just a complete perversion of what good monetary policy should be. Now, Paul Volcker did not expand the monetary base dramatically, period. But Jerome Powell has taken the base. I mean, I think the monetary base, let's call it the balance sheet of the Fed, in 2007 was maybe $850 billion. It's now $7.5 trillion. It was as high as $9 trillion there, recently coming down. But it's not under control. These people do not understand monetary policy, and we're not through with inflation, and they don't get it. And we've had huge damage done by the increase in prices. And, you know, we should get rid of the Fed and put in someone who understands money, and understands how to set a price rule and to make it so that we get that balance sheet of the Fed down to where it's a reasonable amount, maybe $1 trillion. So you do have to have short-term, you know, any type of speculative moving markets and that. But there should be no central tendency for the balance sheet of the Fed to increase over time. It should not. Just the way Volcker ran it, it should run it the way Alan Greenspan did. He did a great, especially in 1987 when we had the big run on the bank. I don't know if you've heard about that. You're too young to remember it. But, I mean, McChesney Martin did a great job on it as well. But these people are just not professionally competent to run monetary policy, and you can see the consequences. I'm not pointing anything out to anyone. 18% inflation in the last 3 years, that's not a good set of policies. They're picking the Fed members based upon some characteristics other than competence in monetary policy, and it's a tragedy. I want my brain surgeon to be the best brain surgeon in the world. I'd much rather have Ben Carson than making sure I don't have a black brain surgeon. I don't want to, you know what I'm saying. You should never pick someone because of external characteristics. It should be because of their competence.
You know, one of the things I learned about you, Dr. Laffer, is that you haven't accepted money or paycheck from a politician, probably not since 1972, I think was right. I think I've heard you say that too, but, you know, being able to... you know, say, like, speak about the economy without worrying about, like, what the boss thinks about the economy.
Yeah. I wrote all these papers back then with the Wall Street Journal, the bitter fruits of devaluation, do devaluations help trade, all the things I just talked about with you. And, you know, we have a long history, a long legacy, and the data all conform in that direction. And I don't know what to say to you, but I lived through it. I've been going to the Oval Office now for 53 straight years. I was the first chief economist at the OMB in the White House in 1970 when George Shultz founded the OMB. I was his right-hand person from the University of Chicago, and I was the first American to go to China in 1970, in October of 1970. We did the pre-Kissinger trip. I went with George Shultz and John Ehrlichman in Air Force Two. So I've been in the play the whole time. I'm an academic. As you probably know, I got the fastest promotion to trade at Chicago, PhD tenure at Chicago.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, you know, I did pretty well, undergraduate as well as graduate. So, you know, so I've mixed the academic and the practical. And the academic has an enormous amount to offer public policy officials. And the public policy debates, if academics would be straight, they have a lot that they could do to make the world better. But, Julia, And this I say, sadly, the reason I have never taken a job with any politician ever since Nixon, and that I did ignorantly, is whenever you work for a politician, you're an employee. And so you have to buy into their political agenda as well as good economics. And I'm going to say this cruelly, but it's true, and you'll understand it. And I really understand, and I feel very sorry for my dear friends who are government economists. They will rebut arguments they know to be true in order to curry favors with their political benefactors. And I am unwilling to do that. I have never taken a job with Reagan or with Trump or with any of them. I've been offered jobs everywhere in all these. I didn't take a job with Dick Cheney, who was my classmate at Yale, when they wanted me to be on the Fed board. Well, I don't do that, because if I do that, Julia, I become an employee, and then I have an oath of loyalty that I have to find, that I have to buy into their political agenda, and I don't. I work with Jared Polis, who's governor of Colorado, all the time. He was my intern when he was 13. I was the chief economist for Gary Hart when he ran for the president in 1988 against Dukakis in the primary. I did Jerry Brown's flat tax when he ran for president in 1992. I worked with Reagan and that type of thing. I worked with Trump. I love Trump. I think he's probably the best economic president we've had, but that's economics. You know, in his first 3 years in office, Trump was probably the single best president I've ever seen. I mean, just amazing. I mean, Reagan was woohoo, wonderful. Jerry Brown was spectacular. Do you remember Jerry Brown's 13% flat tax replacing all federal? That was my baby with Jerry. He's a phenomenal person. Without Jerry Brown, we would not have gotten Prop 13. Now, are you going to call him an ultra right winger, creepy, Neanderthal? No, Jerry Brown, everyone thinks of as super lefty. No, he's not. He's a good economist. And so is Gary Hart, a good economist. And so was Bill Clinton, a good economist. He's a creepy person, but he's a damn good economist. And so was Trump, and so was Reagan. It's policies that matter. It's facts that matter, not political labels. And so therefore, I find it absolutely unacceptable for me to ever take a paycheck from a government politician. Because if I do, I'm bought, sold, and paid for. And I don't that. Do that.
I respect that a lot. And I have to say, Dr. Laffer, it has been an absolute honor. Do you want to let folks know where they can, I think you have a class on macro, anything that you want to plug or parting thoughts before we say goodbye?
I want to plug your podcast. I think it's way cool. You gave me time to talk about some serious things. I mean, there are lots of other things we could talk about. I mean, we could probably do 7 or 8 of these podcasts. Seriously.
We could. You're wonderful. I would have you back on in a heartbeat.
Well, let's do it. If you want to do some other ones that, you know, they're just economic principles. I mean, trade. I could go through the trade stuff with you, or medical transparency, as you may mm-hmm. know that the president gave me credit for the transparency.
Of course. And we didn't even talk about the debt either. And I have questions about that too.
We could go on to debt. Why don't we do another one or two of these if you'd like to?
Let me have the honor to have you back on, I would love to.
Let's do it anytime you want to. And we'll go through, because all of these are just like this. Economics is a science, and it's based on incentive structures. And, you know, medical transparency, I mean, how much, you know, life expectancy in the U.S. has dropped relative to the OECD dramatically, and total health care costs have risen relative to the OECD dramatically. What's wrong with this story? It's 20% of our whole output. You know, when you look at some of these other things, enterprise zones, what's wrong with the inner cities? I live in the south side of Chicago. How can you cure? If you want to go through these, we could get 4 additional podcasts if you'd like to.
I would love it.
An hour on each one of these broad topics, and make it so that your audience can understand the economics and how to make very simple. Al Gore and I, climate warming. You know, it's obvious. If there's climate warming, you know how to fix it. And so do I. And so does Al Gore. And Al Gore and I agree on the plot solution. Now, I'm not a climatologist. I don't know whether there's global warming or not. That's not an economics issue. That's a climatologist issue. But if there is global warming, which makes some sense, it has a crude logic to it, all you want is a carbon tax and offset it with an income tax rate reduction so you don't kill the economy. And then get the hell out of the way. Well, you see what I'm talking about.
I see.
If you want to set up a couple of others, I'd love to do it.
Let's do it. Again, Dr. Art Laffer, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, your ideas, all of your wisdom and lessons. Thank you again. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Julia.